Not all great French food is prepared by chefs. Much of it is made at home by women and men who are as busy as you or me. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Winnie Moranville has spent many hours in French kitchens, cooking, observing, and eating. And in her new cookbook, she makes French home cooking accessible. It's called the Bonne Femme Cookbook, the Good Wife Cookbook, simple, splendid food that French women cook every day. I'll talk with her, then later in the hour, the authors of The Farmstead Chef, recipes that rely on locally grown ingredients. Join our conversation after the news. You're listening to an archive edition of Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up in a little while, I'm going to be talking to the authors of another new cookbook. It's called The Farmstead Chef. We'll find out some secrets to preparing food that's sourced locally. Right now, we're demystifying French food. With me is Winnie Moranville. She's the author of the new cookbook, The Bonne Femme Cookbook. Simple, splendid food that French women cook every day. And you're welcome to join our conversation if you have some experiences with French food that you'd like to share, if Winnie can help you understand something about preparing French food that maybe you've wondered about for a while. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Winnie, let's dig into the cookbook and how you've had it broken down. You start with appetizers and cocktails. So tell me a little bit about the appetizer and cocktail culture in French,
well,
in France.
It's the French make wonderful cocktails, and until recently, they were sort of the domain of hotel bars and resorts. I mean, they were really you don't just go into a casual cafe and order a sidecar. But now they're kind of taking a lead from us, and the cocktail sort of culture's emerging a lot more recently. Of course, they're using their own ingredients. I saw a great recipe for chartreusito, which is the chartreuse liqueur in a mojito, and it was fabulous. It was it was in Bordeaux a couple weeks or last month. It was wonderful, and so of course they use cognac a lot in cocktails, which brings sort of depth and warmth. They really have taken cocktails and run with them in their own direction. And the French love to have their apéritif, which is a little before dinner drink with a little nibble. It's usually, they don't fuss over appetizers like we do. All of the appetizers in my book are very simple.
Well, you say this, but I was surprised when the first page that I opened to was for crackers, homemade crackers. And I thought, wait a minute, that doesn't sound very simple. I buy my crackers.
Oh, of course you can buy your crackers, and they're great. And the French women buy their crackers all the time. And that's why I wrote in the sort of introduction, it's like, French women don't necessarily fuss and make a lot of appetizers. But when they do, they're really nice. And these Comté walnut crackers are really, they're just more like beautiful little nibbles. They kind of stand alone. I mean, you wouldn't serve a cracker by itself, a store-bought cracker by itself, but you could serve one of these by itself as a beautiful, just a fun little bite with a cocktail, and everybody'd be happy.
You devote a chapter to salads, and when we talk about salads, we're not talking about most of the kinds of salads that we see in the United States. You say it's rare to see just lettuce on a plate, right?
Well, they will do lettuce on a plate, but it's usually after a meal with, like a tossed lettuce salad to sort of cleanse the palate with a really garlicky vinaigrette. They will do that once in a while, and they'll sometimes do that little bit with a cheese course just to sort of contrast the rich cheeses. But generally, their salads are very interesting and composed and have something else going on in them. And so I give a lot of different salads, maybe Comté cheese with walnuts and apples. Or, we all love the goat cheese salad, but, the French do something completely different with goat cheese salad than we do. They use a semi-ripened goat cheese, so it melts just beautifully. And, I sort of tell people how to do that and make it the French style of goat cheese salad.
And when you're talking about salads, you're not always talking about something that would be a first course or start a meal. This isn't necessarily the placement that you would have in a meal. meal, right?
Right, exactly. Very often a salad. I mentioned that everybody who's been to France, or knows French cooking says, oh, the French always have salad after a meal. And that's only true when it's just a sort of really simple salad that is meant as a refresher. But very often they can serve a little salad with a meal, the main course, especially if you don't have a sauce on your main course. The salad's dressing can sort of act like a sauce. Or the salad is the main course. I have like a roasted shrimp and green lentil salad. I have lamb, avocado, corn salad. They're very interested to you go in, especially in the cooking of today. This is how the French are sort of lightening up their cooking. Everyday cooking is through sort of combining vegetables with the meats for main dish salads in sort of fresh, light, vivid ways.
Well, and you also see in some of your recipes some influence from other parts of the world in the salads, such as a Spanish influence or influence from the Middle East. There's a tabbouleh salad.
Right. Just like us, France is very interested in global ingredients, but usually they, of course, use them in their own ways.
Johanna is on the line now from Iowa City at 866-780-9100. Hello.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
I was wondering, when I was 14, which is quite a few years ago now, I traveled to Epinal and got together with a bunch of the local French people that I was staying with, the family and their friends, and they served this gelatin mold with meat and what I can remember, peas and some other vegetables. It just looked so unappetizing. I had to try it. It wasn't very good. Just kind of curious where that tradition came from, if it's still alive and flourishing. You know, a little bit of history about that.
Well, I had the same thing in Burgundy, and I think I can't remember what it's called, but you're right. And this was more like it would have ham and parsley in a gelatin mold. I have not seen that. In years. I had that in the late 70s. I think that's kind of gone the way of, what we used to have as, aspic dishes. I don't see that very often. I think that's kind of faded. But I do remember it well, and I remember it was one of the few things that the Lavinia family gave me that I sort of didn't like so much.
So that's,
I agree with you.
That seems to be a tradition that's fading, you think, in France. That's another, one of the things that Julia Child also prepared some things like that. So
right.
I think that
exactly. And believe me, this is not there's not a recipe for that in my book.
I did notice that. But when we think of gelatin, of course, in the United States, we tend to think of desserts, and it came to be popular and really in the 50s and was very popular through the 60s. Was this kind of thing, do you think, popular in France at about the same time, or does it predate our love affair with gelatin?
I don't know that for sure. I do know that I've never seen sort of the jello, the sweet tutti frutti jellos in France that we had. I mean, I think that was a really American thing. But I think the aspic dishes, I think they came about in the 19th century, and they were around for quite a while as sort of a fine dining thing.
And they have gone their way for the most part.
I think so, right. I mean, I am sure that there are some, contemporary French gastronomic chef who have taken the idea and done something beautiful with it. I haven't seen it yet, though.
Well, we were talking earlier about courses, and there's a little bit of confusion about what a main course is when we try to read about French meals. The first course is not the main course, and the main course is not called the main course. But using our terminology, what kind of main courses would you see in home French cooking?
Well, I divided my book into two sort of views of main courses in the French tradition or the French contemporary realm. And one of them is called sauté, deglaze, and serve, where basically you're taking the night's meat, or seafood, you sauté it in the pan, you deglaze the pan by pouring wine and broth into the drippings, with those tasty brown bits in the pan. And then you add, every recipe has a signature touch, like you've got grapes in one, olives sort of in another, celery root, mushrooms, fresh herbs, those sorts of things. It's really French cooking in 30 minutes or less. I mean, think of how our Midwestern grandmothers made gravy. A French woman today will do a light pan, light, fresh, vivid, beautiful pan sauce in just a very little amount of time. And then the second main dish chapter, you know, big main dish chapter, is for when you have a little more time, and it's more of the stews and the roasts and the braises. French women are really good at taking a sort of inexpensive, tough cut of meat and braising it. But again, it doesn't take – once you've sort of got it simmering or in the oven – it's not going to – it's hands-off cooking. It's walk-away cooking, and you just come back and finish it off with a few touches. So it's really, really easy, but it just takes a little more time because it just takes longer to braise. But that's hands-off time.
You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. I'm talking to Winnie Moranville. She has recently written the Bonne Femme Cookbook, Simple Splendid Food That French Women Cook Every Day. And I cannot say it the way that you say it. I've never taken French, so save your emails. next up, we're going to talk to Nicole on the line in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Nicole.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question about?
I recently found croque monsieur to be a recipe that my family loves, but I can never make the Gruyere sauce that goes on top thick enough. It's always really runny, and most of it ends up in the bottom of the pan.
Oh, that's too bad. Well, I have a recipe for, I call it a true croque monsieur, and I want to thank you, first of all, for recognizing that it does have that bechamel sauce on it. A lot of people think a croque monsieur is just a ham and cheese sandwich, but it's not. I mean, the best part of it is that bechamel sauce. It's fabulous. It sounds to me like, you know, you're just maybe adding to, you know, either you need to add more flour when you, you know, start that roux, or you need to add more or add less milk. Just add, maybe start with whatever recipe you're looking at. Start with maybe half the milk they call for. See how that looks, and add a little more as you go.
So it should be firm enough that it sits up on top of the bread before you put the extra Gruyere on.
I like to do it that way. Although, you know, just if it just oozes over the bread just a little, that's okay too. But you're right, you don't want it to make the bread soggy. And the other thing is, be sure to toast your bread before you do that. Otherwise, okay, you did that. Good. Yeah.
Oh yeah, that's
all right.
How it's good.
Yeah,
yes,
that's right.
Thank you so much.
Oh, good. Thank you for calling.
Thanks a lot for your call, Nicole. You also write about soups, and this is something that is more commonly seen at the beginning of a meal as opposed to the salad, where, you know, we would think about that as being the first thing that you eat. And I love the way that you write about soups and how they prime your appetite for the meal. Tell me about that experience.
Yeah, I can't count the times I've sat down to a meal in France and thought, I'm not really hungry. But the French have this saying, l'appétit vient en mangeant, which means the appetite comes in eating. I love that because it's so common that the minute something will sort of hit my lips, especially in the French tradition of serving that first course that's truly meant to be a, you know, appetite-rousing course, you know, then all of a sudden you start getting hungry again, and you're sort of primed for things to come. And the French first course soups are generally always really sort of lighter, fresher, appetite rousing, rather than, you know, so often how many times you've gotten a soup in a restaurant that's basically been leftover baked potatoes and, you know, chunks of things that are just big and heavy. And, you know, it's like that's a meal in itself sometimes. So the French really don't do that to you. They'll start you off with something that will really get you ready for the next course.
I think we often hear from people who come and visit the United States how ridiculously huge our portion sizes are, particularly at restaurants. But I suppose we probably do that at home, too, a lot of us. How large are portion sizes? If you're eating four courses, obviously you can't have large portions.
Well, they do have, you know, first of all, the plates are usually smaller. You know, we've gotten to these huge, the actual dinner plates are large, so we fill them up. Their plates are a little smaller. And I think that they will serve a little less of the protein, whatever that is. But what they serve a lot less of are those side dishes. I mean, nobody bulks up their dish with, you know, a huge amount of rice and a huge amount of pasta, you know, and just a tumble of lackluster vegetables. Everything is really well portioned so that, you know, if you're going to eat another course, you'll really enjoy the next course.
Julia's on the line from Marion. Hello, Julia.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
Yes, I had something in the Jura region of France, and I'm not really sure what it was. It was a liqueur. It was called Van John, I think, and I've been trying to explain it to my husband, and I can't.
did you like Van John?
Yeah, I did, actually.
Good, good. I liked it, too, but I was in the Jura region, too. It's in eastern France. It's beautiful. I love that region. I loved Vangeaune when I was there, but I took it home and drank it, and I didn't like it here. It was very interesting. It's almost like you have to, it's one of those things you have to drink. It's somewhat of a sherry-like wine, and, you know, it has that oxidized sort of flavor to it. And I drink it like sherry, but I tell you, I think you'll have a hard time finding it here. And to tell you the honest truth, I don't know. I think you have to eat it with the right things. Like they serve it very often with their Comté cheese, which is that, you know, their version of Gruyere, which is fabulous. And so if you have a little Comté cheese and you have a little Vangeaune, great. But yeah, I tried to serve it to some friends here in Des Moines, and they were like, not so much.
It just tastes better in France.
Yeah.
I wanted to know, can you get Fromage Blanc anywhere in Iowa?
I have seen it at Gateway Market in Des Moines. But you know what? I think a pretty good substitution is the Faye Greek yogurt. It's not the same thing. If you're cooking with it, it's not the same thing. But if you're serving it like a dessert like the French do, where you throw in a little honey, or honey and pine nuts is a typical, honey, pine nuts, and fromage blanc. If you're doing that, the Faye yogurt will be if it's an 8 on a scale of 1 to 10 when compared to fromage blanc. So it's pretty darn good.
Julia, thanks a lot for your call. And you bring up dessert. You have a chapter on desserts, but I love what you write in the beginning of that chapter, and that is that you've almost never been served a homemade dessert in France.
You know, I really don't think I have. And I've sat down to tables quite often, and you know, the French women really don't have to make their beautiful pies and tarts and cake. Every neighborhood has a pâtisserie. So they'll just buy something that's gorgeous and serve that. But, you know, I also put in my when they do make homemade desserts, they're usually very, you know, kind of simple. They have the clafoutis, they have the upside down cakes, of course, creme caramel. And I will say that supermarket desserts, that just like their versions of puddings and things like that are phenomenally good. And I'm so jealous because I go over there and, you know, for like a dollar, you can have this, you know, two packages of really good chocolate mousse. And it's just, and my French friends will say, oh, that's industrial. And they'll sort of roll their eyes at it. But, you know, I'm like, it's wonderful. It's actually really good. So I get spoiled when I go there. One thing I don't cook a lot of in France is desserts. I just don't cook a lot of desserts. But once home, I miss the things I ate in France, so I will cook them.
And you also write about the French version of the ice cream sundae, which you say is a simple way to end a meal. Tell us about that. We're almost out of time.
Oh, sure. Well, the Glacier in France is the ice cream shop, and they're often part of cafes. And they just combine beautiful ice cream flavors with different syrups and fruits and things like that and very often liqueurs. You know, put a liqueur on an ice cream, and it's just fabulous. And that's just a great way, an easy way to end a meal. And people, it's unexpected. It sounds, we call it a sundae, which doesn't sound, you know, that fancy. But they have the coupe de glace, and it's just a lovely way to finish. And I give a lot of ideas on how to do that.
Winnie, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Winnie Moranville reviews restaurants for the Des Moines Register, and she's just written the Bonne Femme Cookbook, simple, splendid food that French women cook every day. You can find a link to her website on our Facebook page if you go to Iowa Public Radio on Facebook, jbonnefemme.com. Coming up in just a moment, we'll talk about cooking a little more locally. The Farmstead Chef, coming up next. This is Talk of Iowa. Not all great French food is prepared by chefs. Much of it is made at home by women and men who are as busy as you or me. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Winnie Moranville has spent many hours in French kitchens, cooking, observing, and eating. And in her new cookbook, she makes French home cooking accessible. It's called the Bonne Femme Cookbook, the Good Wife Cookbook, simple, splendid food that French women cook every day. I'll talk with her, then later in the hour, the authors of The Farmstead Chef, recipes that rely on locally grown ingredients. Join our conversation after the news. You're listening to an archive edition of Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. When you think of cooking French food, something like this might come to mind.
Hello, I'm Julia Child. Welcome to The French Chef and the first show on our series on French cooking. We're going to make bœuf bourguignon, beef stew, and red wine.
Winnie Moranville wants to introduce you to a different kind of French cooking, simple, wholesome home cooking. She reviews restaurants for the Des Moines Register and has just published a new cookbook called the Bonne Femme Cookbook, simple, splendid food that French women cook every day. And she's here with us today. Hello, Winnie.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And before we start talking about your experiences with French food, let's demystify the title of the book, the Bonne Femme Cookbook. What does that mean?
Well, in French, bonne femme means the good wife. It literally means the good wife. But in French cooking, it refers to the more simple, uncomplicated food that's served in homes, no matter who does the cooking, husband, wife, friend, or partner. Bonne femme also is really when someone refers to their bonne femme, they're referring to their housewife or, their wife, a housewife.
So when did you first start experiencing French food and this kind of French food?
Well, when I was 16, I went on a cultural exchange trip through Roosevelt High School here in Des Moines, and I stayed with a family in Burgundy. And that just opened my eyes to the way French women cook in their homes. And every night we sat down to a beautiful meal with Monsieur and Madame Lavinia and their daughters, who were my teenage daughters, Annie and Françoise. And we just had these lovely meals, but they weren't really that complicated. They would just start off with a pâté that Madame had bought at a local charcuterie. And then we'd move on to something like a stew, just really lovely stew with some vegetables. Then we'd have a little cheese course, and then she'd bring out some sort of dessert. Sometimes it would be something she bought at a bakery. But we ate these beautiful meals night after night, and it wasn't that difficult for her, I don't think, to bring these foods to the table.
And what was it about that experience? Obviously, you've had a lifelong relationship with France and with French cooking, but what was it about that experience with that food that stayed with you and kept coming back to you?
I don't know. I mean, I think growing up in Iowa with, my grandparents lived on a farm and, food was a huge part of getting together there. So it's always been with me. But the French aspect of it just made me realize that, you can also cook French food, or there's this whole other side of cooking that I hadn't been familiar with that just tasted so good to me. And I just wanted to continue to pursue it.
So as time went on, how did you continue your relationship with France and French food?
Well, my first job out of college, I worked for Société Générale, a French bank in New York. And so I worked with French executives who were expats from France, and they talked about food all the time. They, we'd go out to lunch or dinner. They had a private dining room in for the executives to eat at. They were sometimes, they'd treat the staff to beautiful meals there. So that was really beginning. And then while I lived in New York, I started reading Pierre Frenet's 60-Minute Gourmet column in the New York Times, and he was a French chef. And that just opened – he was the first French chef really to sort of demystify French cooking and say, you can get a great French meal on the table in 60 minutes or less. I've taken that and tried to make it 30 minutes or less. But that sort of opened my eyes to a certain everyday style of French cooking. And then as I got into my 30s, my husband and I started traveling to France every year and renting a little apartment every year in various places. And that allowed me to really, really cook, I believe, like the French, or like a French woman would. I met French women along the way. I read cooking magazines. I talked to butchers and you know, market, the produce people in the market. You know, just found out, what do people do? How do people cook in France? And then I was able to just bring that home.
And as you were writing about food for an American audience, you noticed that there was a real trend of people embracing Italian country cooking, this kind of home cooking from Italy. We're not just talking about pizza and pasta, but so much more than that. And when did it occur to you that, wait a minute, why are we always talking about Italy and not talking about France?
Well, I think that's exactly right. Part of what I do for a living is I've been writing and editing for many cookbooks within the Better Homes and Gardens family of publications. And I saw how people totally embraced Italian cooking, Mexican cooking, American cooking, you know, just that could be an everyday thing. But nobody looked at French cooking that way. And it's really hard to get people to see French cooking that way, because our sort of experiences with French food is in this sort of, originally it was in those chandeliered restaurants with tuxedoed maitre d's and flambé tableside, all these little gadgets that said, don't try this at home, when really that kind of cooking that we grew up with, or that kind of view of French cooking that we grew up with, really doesn't bear a whole lot in relation to how women really cook in their homes. And so this book is sort of hopefully my way of showing people that you can cook like a French person does every day.
Well, I think we have sort of a dichotomy when we think about French food, and I guess I'll speak for myself as someone who's never been to France. You know, I think about the baguettes and the bread and cheese and wine, but I also think about the kinds of recipes that we saw Julia Child make with so much butter,
right?
You know, and the kind of thing that you really can't eat every day. So I think a lot of us don't have an understanding of what French people actually eat every day.
Well, that's exactly right. And I think that there has been a shift. French women are also trying to make their cuisine fresher and lighter. I do use butter, but always in moderation. I use cream, maybe a tablespoon of cream at the end of a recipe to finish off a sauce. This is the way French women cook today. They don't put a lot of butter and cream in their food anymore, because you know, you really can't eat like that, and they don't want to eat like that anymore either. Once in a while, sure, you know, you will see a very heavy recipe, but really that's not everyday cooking.
When you were eating with this family that you lived with in France, and you write about this in the book as well, it sounds like it's rare for a French family to sit down to a meal that doesn't include several different separate courses. Is that really the way people eat every day?
That is so funny that you ask, because I have asked that when I meet French people. I always ask them. That's one of the questions, you know, once I get to know someone, I'm like, so tell me how you eat. And they'll always say, well, you know, we sit down, we have something to start with, you know, raw vegetables or maybe pâté. And then we'll have a main course, you know, with the little vegetables. And I always bring out a piece of cheese and have that with some bread. And usually, you know, we'll have a little dessert, maybe some ice cream or a little yogurt, you know, with fromage blanc with a little sweetening, you know, some sort of jam on it or something. And then they always say to me, but, you know, most French people don't always eat like that. You know, a lot of French people don't eat like that anymore. But yet I have never met one who doesn't, who is the person who says, well, I just, you know, grab a bite and run. I've never met someone who does that. But so there's this, you know, French people are quick to tell me that they eat in full four courses, but they're also quick to tell me that not all French people do that. I still haven't met one who doesn't.
But the way that we think about sitting down to a home-cooked meal that we feel really good about, we may have a main course on the plate with a couple of sides and maybe some bread, and that's a really good night.
Yes.
You would not get a plate in France that has all of your food on one plate.
Well, right. Like. I don't really think that the French eat more than we do. I think they just stretch it out a little bit. So they really do enjoy every bit, every course. And I think that's just, it's a fun way to eat. But I stress in my book, look, if you don't want to eat in courses, if you don't want to serve your guest in courses, that's absolutely fine. You know, you should eat the way you like to eat and the way you're accustomed and that's comfortable for you. Or, you know, sometimes eat in courses on the weekend, sometimes not. Some of my favorite way to entertain actually is to put out just a buffet of wonderful food and have people, you know, pick at it like a fork supper. It's plenty of food, and they can go. They can eat. The guest can eat in courses. They can start with a few little things, and then move on, and then you know go back for the sweet things. You know, I just think it's all what you're comfortable doing. I must say, I enjoy eating in courses. It just spreads the meal out. It gives you more time to linger and talk to people and enjoy your day.
Well, and that's my next question: is if so many French people are still eating this way, eating in courses, how long does dinner take in France?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I think, with the Lavigne family in Burgundy, I mean, remember, this is in the late 70s. So, I don't know if people, when people's lives in France have sped up just like ours have, but they still carve out a place in their day for a nice meal with their friends or family. With the Levine family, I remember thinking, and I didn't have – my French wasn't that good, and I would never have asked, like, but how many more courses are we going to have? When can I go to bed? You know, I mean, it took me a while to sort of get into the rhythm of how they were going to spend, 2 hours at the table every night. But that is not as common anymore. I really think a good French meal would be an hour. And most – again, when I eat in French homes, it's sort of – I'm a guest, so of course it's usually an evening's worth of eating. But I think an average French meal would probably be about an hour.
And so when you sit down for a meal of all of these courses, does the person, the woman or the man who's prepared the food, do they have everything done in advance so they get to sit down with the family or with the guests? Or is someone constantly running back to the kitchen and preparing things?
No, I mean, most of the things are – what I love about French cooking and what we can really learn from it is – really, you don't have to cook everything. Source beautiful things locally. For example, when I cook for people, very often my first course will be like La Quercia prosciutto, maybe with a few deviled eggs and some roasted asparagus. And I'll just put a platter in the middle of the table. So that's all, that doesn't take a lot of time.
I'm talking to Winnie Moranville. She's the author of the Bonne Femme Cookbook, Simple, Splendid Food That French Women Cook Every Day. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. And you're welcome to join us if you have some experiences with French food that you'd like to share. Maybe Winnie can help you demystify some of the food that you've eaten. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Charity Nebbe, and this is an archive edition of Talk of Iowa. With more people growing their own vegetables and shopping locally, buying into CSAs, many of us are learning to cook in a new way. John Ivanko and Lisa Kivarist have been cooking this way for the last 15 years or so as the proprietors of Serendipity Bed and Breakfast in Greene County, Wisconsin. They share some of their secrets in the new book, Farmstead Chef. Hello, John and Lisa.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today. And I think if you've ever been faced with a box of stuff from a CSA and thought, what on earth am I going to do with this? We will take your call if you have some questions. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Before we start talking about the food itself, let's talk about your journey back to the land. This is not the kind of lifestyle you grew up with.
No, Charity. We started out in that cubicle doing corporate jobs in Chicago with weekly paychecks, and we're coming up to Wisconsin. Typical tourist stuff, biking, hiking, camping on the weekends, and really fell in love with the rural landscape and the farm setting, and all of a sudden started reevaluating the career paths we were expected to do and turned to the farmstead for our new roots and new livelihoods, and have been learning about growing, cooking, and living the farmsteadarian lifestyle ever since.
So you moved to this farm where you live, what, in 1996?
Yep, 1996. And a part of the story, too, Charity, is that we really wanted to get out of that earn-spend cycle, stuck in a cubicle, seemingly going nowhere and working really hard to make money for someone else, and we weren't really seeing any part of it all. And we weren't very self-sufficient at all. In fact, if we needed just about anything from the tomato in our tomato casserole in the morning or to the energy we use, we had to go to some corporation to provide everything for us. So part of our shift, really, and what the Farmstead Chef Cookbook celebrates is, you know, getting, you know, regaining that sense of self-reliance and locality and growing some of our own food. And in our case, we actually generate more than all of the electricity we use on site here at In Serendipity.
Right. You use wind energy and solar as well?
Uh-huh. Wind and solar, and have several different uses of the heat that we so enjoy, and especially comes a little rare as we move into the wintertime. But we use two different solar thermal systems as well.
So as you moved back to the land and then started going through this transition process, learning to farm, really, learning to cook with this food, was it a little bit daunting to look at all of this fresh food that you probably hadn't even had access to necessarily living in Chicago and think about making all your meals out of it?
Well, that's a great question, and something we definitely have been learning as we go of how to both deal with and celebrate and savor the abundance. And that's the essence of the message in Farmstead Chef, is you don't have to be a chef to be a great cook. You don't have to start big. You can start small. And that's been a big part of our journey of constantly pecking away at things, constantly learning new things, dealing with whatever the abundance of the garden is at the time, and also picking away at all the things that we would typically buy processed. There's recipes in the cookbook and anything from graham crackers to maraschino cherries to puff pastry dough of things we'd normally buy off a shelf in a box. How can we make that at home using pantry staple ingredients?
And I'm really sure that a lot of folks there in Iowa know all about that sense of frugality when you're stocking up and putting away for the winter use. And we over the last 15 years, have really embraced that. And we do a lot of freezing, and we have a chest freezer in our basement, but we figure out certain things just absolutely have to be enjoyed fresh. And so the cookbook kind of breaks things out that way, too. The things that you want to eat fresh, like strawberries right at the beginning of the June period, but they do freeze well from our perspective, too, so we can use them in smoothies any time of the year. So we have a very berry smoothie recipe in the cookbook as well. So it's two different ways to go with something, and we have some fresh salad options, and then we have the frozen strawberry option. So we figured out some of these things over the last 15 years, and as Lisa likes to point out sometimes, frozen zucchini doesn't age well like wine does. So it's really something, if you do freeze it, you want to use it all up at the year's end. And so part of our stories, too, and there are a lot of stories and little tips and so forth in the cookbook, you know, talks about some of the strategies we've developed as a part of that.
I'm talking to John Ivanko and Lisa Kivarist about their new book, The Farmstead Chef. And if you have questions, if you have been faced with that box of stuff from the CSA, or maybe you have stuff left over in your garden that you're trying to figure out how to use this year, give us a call and maybe they can help you out. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk, or you can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And let's talk a little bit about some of the recipes in here, because this is not going back to early 1900s farm cookbook from Wisconsin or from Iowa. You make some international dishes, you make some very modern dishes. So how did you decide what recipes really passed your test and could make it into the book?
Yeah, that's the essence of the Farmstead Chef idea, that we can incorporate all of these global influences that we have today in our rural countryside, thanks to the internet, thanks to living in a more mobile society, that we can put an Indonesian peanut sauce, for example, on our asparagus pasta, or we made last night a spanakopita, which is a Greek-influenced spinach pie with the last of our fall greens. So we have been collecting and savoring and sharing recipes in our kitchen for years. The Farmstead Chef Cookbook has some of our favorite staples, particularly from the bed and breakfast side, and then a collection of recipes, too, that friends, fellow farmers and food activist friends of ours have contributed in the Kitchen Table Talk series as well. So you're right, it's a very eclectic global potpourri, but that's one of the perks of being in the Farmstead Kitchen today and being able to savor all those different flavors and to stock up on the pantry so you can have that, oh, the Thai red curry paste when you want to make the chicken satay and have those things on hand so we don't need to always be running out to the store or running through the takeout line to eat.
Yeah, well, that's one of the unique things I think that we've found, and we're really frustrated with a lot of other cookbooks that, you know, they you get to a certain part in going through a recipe and then, good grief, you don't have this particular ingredient, and so that kind of put the kibosh on continuing with the recipe. Well, we have a Farmstead pantry checklist. It's like a two-page section in the, you know, near the back of the book. But if you go out and had all of these things on hand, you're pretty much good to go for the entire cookbook. And there aren't that many obscure ingredients in there, but Lisa mentioned one of them. But if you go through that checklist and you get them all together, then you're set to go.
Well, and you describe the fact that you want all of the recipes to pass the grandmother test, and a lot of these recipes are not ones that either one of my grandmothers would have made. So what is the grandmother test?
Oh, you got us there. You know, grandmothers, I think it all depends on their culinary background and their training. What we wanted to do is create a cookbook that didn't or wasn't placed on the coffee table. With the fancy photographs and you know, highly complex recipe concoctions and so forth. What we're trying to do is make it as accessible as much as possible and provide a range of recipes in the book. So there are some more straightforward and simple ones, because running a bed and breakfast, the last thing we wanted to be doing is waking up at 2 in the morning to get going and making breakfast that we'll serve at 8:30. So there's a lot of simple ways of making some of our morning sweetbreads that you do actually the night before, and then you have it in the freezer or refrigerator, and then you bring it right out and stick it in the oven and you're good to go and be able to feed quite a few people, especially as these holidays are rolling around the corner. Some folks probably love to have a pumpkin peanut butter bread loaves ready to go for the crowds they have to feed in the next morning. So we've really tried to incorporate some of those recipes in, and then there are some like the Latvian pirogs recipe, if you can even get it said right, that does have a few more steps, but there are a wide range of folks out there that have different experiences and skill sets, and so we wanted to provide some interesting variations on appetizers, in this case, which is a bacon onion mixture and or surrounded by sort of a little bakery bread. And they're just delicious. That's one of our son's favorite things. Of course, it had bacon in it, so who couldn't be happy with that?
Mary is on the line right now from Grinnell at 866-780-9100, and you're welcome to join our conversation as well. Hello, Mary.
Hi. I'm visiting Grinnell from the Willamette Valley, Eugene, Oregon, and we do a lot of drying of fruit there, and I'm wondering if you have experimented with that as a way of preserving fruit.
We have indeed. Actually, our son, our 10-year-old son, Liam, had the drying palooza of the summer. He had a bumper basil crop, so much so that he converted his clubhouse, which actually is a converted old chicken coop, into a drying center for the basil. So we do some of that like he does. We basically just dry things the natural way and then flip them upside down and put them in dark, cool, shaded areas. And use particularly with herbs in that matter. But there's so much you can do with dehydrating. You're exactly right.
One of the things we did with the Farmstead Chef Cookbook, too, is provide both fresh and dry options for the recipes to allow folks, depending on what they have right from their garden or what they may have put up as in a dry form, to be able to go back and forth rather quickly between those. Because to the extent we can, I mean, we actually now have dill available in our garden, which we should not have at this time of the year. And so anytime we have a calling like the Spanakopita where we can incorporate in a little fresh dill, we'll go for it.
Mary, thanks a lot. Oh, did you have something to add?
Well, I just wanted to comment that I found that drying fruit is a terrific way of preserving it, and you don't add any, like, dried strawberries, and then I just throw them into salads or sweetbreads in the winter.
That's fantastic, Mary. And you raise a really good point that we try to bring up in the pages of the cookbook as well, that food is very much a personal passion. And when you look at food preservation techniques, find what you're interested in. I personally am a big freezer. We have a 13 cubic foot chest freezer in the basement, and I blanch and freeze and shred all summer. Part of that is due to time on my end, and part of that is that it simply works with our lifestyle. But drying, canning, root cellaring, there's so many different options, and you can pick and choose between them. But to find one, as Mary sounds with the dehydrating, that you really love and enjoy both the doing part and the eating part.
Mary, thanks a lot for your call. And, you know, obviously, since you've dedicated your entire lifestyle to being self-sufficient, living off the land, and you also have a bed and breakfast, you have a lot of people to feed, food is a much larger focus of your lives than it is for most of us. But it seems to me that you made an effort in the book to not just include, or maybe not at all include, special occasion recipes. These are recipes that they all fit on a page, and they all seem to be doable in not too long a time.
Indeed. Now that you bring it up, Charity, I don't think we even refer to holidays or Christmas or the typical special occasion meals, because what we have in the cookbook are special meals in the essence of the everyday. And to what you just said, that we can create these tasty seasonal meals without a lot of complication, without a lot of effort outside of what we're doing in our home kitchens. And that return to the home kitchen and that sharing of the cooking process and, importantly, the eating process is a core element of what we write about.
Yeah, for example, though, our pumpkin mousse cheesecake, that is one of the recipes in the book, we put that up against any of those grandmas with their pumpkin pie, traditional pie recipe at Thanksgiving. It's just a very different approach to something, and we find that sometimes you have to sweeten it, make it a little different way to get more folks to appreciate the wonderful flavors that go with pumpkin. Ours, however, also goes a few steps further, which is a little bit more complex, but we have our own graham cracker crust, and you can make that from scratch without too much effort, using real whipped cream instead of the stuff that sprays out of a bottle. And so we give a real simple recipe on how to whip that up.
A lot of us have become accustomed to shopping at farmers markets, and a lot of people are getting food, fresh food, local food through CSAs or growing their own. But you also encourage people to get out and forage. What do you mean by that?
The foraging side, we are loving that here in Wisconsin, of being able to basically literally eat out our back door, be it foods in the wild, be it we have a lot of fruit trees in our area, in people's lots, in people's backyards in town. Often they're seniors who planted the trees 30, 40 years ago and are not physically able to pick them anymore. So that's been our bounty of foraging, particularly this time of year, of connecting with our local senior community, knocking on doors, offering to pick their pear tree, whatever may be in their backyard, and sharing that harvest with them. But there's always more than enough to go around when we start foraging locally.
And but, you see a lot of food that could be eaten not being harvested, not being taken into homes?
There are many times when that in fact is the case. And so we think it's food we believe, you know, can really bring communities together. And, you know, who makes a pot of soup and eats it themselves? I mean, it's meant to be shared. And so we see, you know, this search for and part of the foraging aspect of things is reaching out to people in the community that you might not necessarily have crossed paths with. And we, of all things, actually ended up free. We had such an abundant crop, or had planted so much garlic this several years ago. We actually free-cycled our garlic scapes, which is those curly Q things that come out of the top of stiff-neck garlic. And sure enough, the three or four people sent us a quick email back saying, hey, I love some of those. And then the next paragraph was, well, what do you do with them? And so it was a great way to begin a sort of this relationship with people in the community. And then when we dropped them off, we saw a pile of old tomato cages that didn't seem like they were being used. And we asked, well, what are you doing with those? And they said, well, actually, we were going to take those off to the dump. And so we took them instead for our tomatoes. So it's that kind of power that we see food is being, and it's very much sort of a gateway to discovering renewable energy and discovering local economies where food is, where money is like food is staying within the community, not being set off to some corporation far, far away. And that, in many cases, with a lot of the food, is what happens. You know, because it is traveling such a great distance to get to our grocery store now, unless you grow it in your backyard or shop at a farmer's market. So the idea is to reconnect with the local and celebrate that and savor the abundance. And foraging fits into that too, in the whole wild food arena. And, you know, around, I can't wait already until springtime when we get to go out and do our roughly 2 or 3 week search for morel mushrooms. And I know that they may be available in your area as well that time of year. And it's fun. It gets us outside, but it also is the ultimate of local, is something that grows and only in one part or certain parts of the country.
Well, John and Lisa, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
John Ivanko and Lisa Kivarist, they are the authors of Farmstead Chef. Again, you can find a link to their website on our Facebook page, inserendipity.com. It shares a lot of recipes from the Farmstead Chef cookbook. Talk of Iowa was produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Emily Woodbury and from Emily Boyer as well. I'm Charity Nebbe. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.